This will be a recording of the Surface Mining Advisory Committee on April 11th, Thursday, April 11th, 2019.
All right. Welcome to Yakult Mountain number two, the Surface Mining Advisory Committee Forum. I'd like to first announce to everybody that this meeting is being recorded. We'll be utilizing that information from our point to create a meeting summary that will be passed out and made available to folks on our website, which we'll go through in just a minute. I'd like to start with a round of introductions. We've got some new people here, and I'll start. My name is Mitch Nichols. I'm the Community Development Director for Clark County.
My name is Dick Lewenberg. I'm with the East Fork Community Coalition.
Nick Edgar, I'm a resident on Gabriel Road.
Marie Oger with the East Fork Coalition, Community Coalition.
Gary Oger, same.
James Naramore, Deputy. I'm a Commercial Beacon Enforcement Deputy for the Sheriff's Office.
Ulster Hall Operator.
Mark Rose, EFCC.
Charlie Christopher, I'm resident of Yackel.
Yes. Richard Deeren, Friends of the East Fork.
Michelle Stewart, I'm a resident of Battleground.
Great. Brian Stewart, a resident of Rock Creek Road.
Okay.
And East Fork Coalition.
Nick Simmons from Collis County.
Claudia Frost from Collis County.
Thank you.
Erin Ellie with the Parcel Network Association.
Craig Shaw.
And Shaw. Thank you.
And?
Katie. Marilyn McCall, Neighborhood Program Coordinator and Scribe for the evening.
Katie Jarvis, East Fork Community Coalition.
Thank you. You're a diligent reporter.
I'm Jacob Cranham in Clark County today.
Fantastic. Thank you. This is kind of technology, so we need to speak up as we speak. And if we have questions from anyone in the back, I'll be happy to repeat the question here before we actually develop an answer for you. But you're also welcome to come join us. We have seats. All right. First, I'd like to get the communications we received, and they have been included in the packets that are prepared over here. If you haven't got a packet, we've got a sign-in sheet and agendas over there. And as promised, these are the communications we've received from members of the community regarding the meetings and regarding their concerns. And it's important for us to make sure that we're as mindful as we possibly can be about everybody's concerns and making sure that we have an opportunity to have those discussions here as we come to our conclusions and our agreements. And that said, I would encourage everyone to take a minute to read through these, to familiarize yourselves with them, and then we'll ask the authors, if they are here, to talk a little bit about them, to inform everybody as to what the intent and objectives are. So we can give 5 minutes for the reading, if that's all right. Okay, great. Thank you all. So, a couple of things that brought up that I've seen in the communications. A lot of questions about scheduling, and we will, for public meetings, we utilize a process that is established by Clark County, and that requires us to publish the notification in the paper, and we post it on our websites. If we have your email address, we'll be sending you a notice in advance of that posting. In other words, when we send the notice to the paper, you'll also receive a notice of that meeting as soon as we can get it ready for the paper. But that's really as much as we can do for that outside of making, you know, any other additional effort beyond that.
Did that happen last time? We had a lot of people sign up.
Nobody got it.
So it didn't. We're aware of that.
Okay.
That's why, hence the comments that we got.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So all those email addresses that have been provided to us will be added to our contacts list for this particular website.
Just to be complete, provided means what? I thought when it got on there that was provided. Is that provided?
So that's provided to us.
Okay.
If you don't receive it or it bounces back, we'll reach out to you and correct it and say, hey, we've got, you know, we didn't get to you as you intended us to do. Do we need a correction on the writing, just in case we can't read it?
So that's going forward. That's
yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a little bit of a rocky start. Glad to see this much interest, though. This is fantastic for us. It's great for the decision-making process and the discussion to have this much involvement. We don't want to inadvertently chase people away through by virtue of lack of communication. We also raised the road conditions are, again, a recurring issue up there, and there was a suggestion about how they might get repaired and who might be responsible for that. And that's some of the challenges that we face as a county is providing public repair of public roads. And to be able to attribute it to one user or another is a bit difficult. And I think we accommodated some of that in the CUP. But I think we can probably do better, especially if we can attribute it directly to a particular type of traffic. If you look at the bridge survey that we recently did where we had to reevaluate the bridge capacities, this was an opportunity for us to look at a particular set of circumstances around a capacity from a road or a bridge and determine how are we going to best serve this need. In this case, we had to reduce the weight limits on the bridges, but we still have to replace those bridges. We can't necessarily burden anyone but the taxpayers for that work because it is something that we can't say, you know, unless somebody like a driver or a truck just drives into the side of the bridge and damages it, we really don't have a way of looking at anyone as a culpable party for that. We have to go to our tax base in order to fund those repairs. For the surface mining operations, we did write things into the CUPs that ensured that there was some accountability at a number of different levels, including the trip counts, the hourly trips, depending on the mining operation, is the CUPs were specific to each operation. So they differ quite a bit dependent on the operation, location, and the roads. There's also some question about the roads being utilized in this particular, for the Acko Mountain. And Mr. Rose, if you'd be kind enough to explain your concerns.
Sure, sure. So I live at the base of Kelly Road. And my girls volunteer out at Royal Ridges quite frequently. So between my wife and I, we are shuttling them back and forth. And really noticed, and my wife actually made a comment about it, that the road conditions, essentially on Yakult Mountain Road to Gabriel Road, are awful. And they were just actually recently repaired in October. I think there was a gentleman here at the last forum who provided comment on the cost for just those repairs in October, which was around $200,000. And I made it a point on one of my trips to count the different decaying or conditions, faulty conditions from the quarry entrance to Gabriel Road, which is about 1 mile. I think it might be just under 1 mile. And there are 46 different instances on the right-hand lane from Macquarie to Gabriel Road, where it's either potholes, or it's sinking, or it's decaying, or it's been repaired and it's sinking again. And I don't even know what Gabriel Road's like. I haven't been on Gabriel Road for a while.
I can actually speak to that because we're just a few properties down from Royal Ridges. So on our daily drives, we're going pretty much from where you leave off to 503. Mm-hmm. It's a similar thing where the westbound lane, the outbound lane, that's where all the potholes and patches and everything are. Right now there's, I didn't do a count, but there's at least 12 to 15 spots off the top of my head. There's one pothole currently in the other lane coming the other direction. So I think it's pretty clear from the increased amount of heavy truck traffic that's on that road. And that's something that I was going to speak to later on as well. But there's definite damage that's all in one lane, and it got repaired last year, and there's potholes all over again. So I think the roads need to be re-engineered.
Okay, so that was so that's a good observation. So we're insinuating that or intimating that the outbound trips, the loaded trucks, mm-hmm. are part of the cause for that degradation of the road surfaces.
Versus
the inbound trucks, which are not loaded.
Yes. Yeah,
there's not nearly as many issues from Lucia Falls up Kelly to the entrance of the quarry as there is from the quarry, trucks leaving the quarry to Gabriel Road.
Right.
And that would be my guesstimate would be that's because it's the difference between loaded and unloaded trucks.
Right. And this wasn't an issue 15 years ago.
Well, and I would even say that it seems to have gotten worse the last 3 to 2 years, 2 to 3 years.
I would agree with that.
I drove that road many times before, and I don't remember it being nearly as bad.
Bo, a question for you is have you all ever contributed or made efforts to repair roads in that area?
During the CUP, we paid a certain amount per ton, the first 3.5 million ton that was sold out of the pit,
mm-hmm.
and that was to better reinforce those roads due to the impacts that we would be putting on the road system.
Okay.
So we fulfilled an obligation that we agreed to going into the permit, that we'll pay this money, and that was what we agreed to.
Okay. When did that expire?
It would have been 2014, I would say.
Remember what the total amount of that was? Because I'm looking back at the hearing examiner notes. There was a proposal for how much they thought that fee should be, and then they reduced it by like 90%.
I don't remember that, but I think it was 3 cents a ton on the first 3.5 million tons sold. So whatever that comes out to.
So have you sold the first 3.5 tons
yeah,
already?
Yeah, 2014, that was fulfilled. That obligation that we agreed to was fulfilled.
On the 1 year. So, I at the very least, I want to get back with the Mod Kayumi and ask if the capital projects list includes these roads, Yakult Mountain and Gabriel. Just ask it outright, find out when they're planning on doing that.
And I had nothing to do with where the money was spent.
Right.
I just was charged for the first 3.5 million.
So I did the math on that. The if 2.5 cents, or 2.5 cents per load or per ton, at 3.5 million tons is 85,000 over the course of 15 years, or 3.5 million tons per. So that, you know, just the last set of repairs in October was $200,000 alone, which needs to be done again or completely redone.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is I think that these roads are not engineered to take this kind of repeated load.
Right.
And I think that's that's definitely something that needs to be looked at. Otherwise, the county is just going to have this recurring cost, and the roadbeds will continue to deteriorate. They can't just slap something on top of it. I mean, that really needs to be looked at.
So I want to explore the intent of the CUP requirement for that. I mean, if it was to reinforce the surface to make it mm-hmm. capable of withstanding these loads with minimal degradation, then I'd like to know that. And if it,
and, know, and was it, was anything actually done before, towards that?
Towards that end, right.
Within an $80,000 budget.
I don't think.
Well, but that's above and beyond what truckers pay to even access public roads to. We can't discount that. I mean,
right.
Truckers pay at the fuel pump. They pay in tonnage. I mean, they have more impacts on the road system, so that's why they pay more. So it's not just $80,000 and it didn't fix the problem. It's above and beyond what's already paid for.
Just for those of us who have absolutely no knowledge whatsoever of what you just said, what do truckers pay? I mean, is it...
It's adjusted annually. I'd have to see what it is. But at the pump, you pay in excess for every gallon of fuel that you burn. You pay that at the pump, and that
ballpark. Is it an extra dollar a gallon? Is it an extra?
I couldn't tell you. It's just what I pay.
Okay.
I don't know what percentage of that goes to the state for road, improvements.
Okay. So it's a fuel tax, like
it's an IFTA. It's an IFTA regulation that every dump truck has to have.
It's over and above what, let's say,
it goes to the state, and the state distributes that back to the county that you deliver into, and just like when you pay sales tax, it goes to the state, and then a percentage comes back to the county. So the revenue, and that's another thing, the revenue at the pit that it generates in sales taxes all throughout the county, I mean, that goes to the state, and that comes back. So it's not like it's not getting redistributed, and there isn't money available to fix the roads. I mean, it comes from everywhere.
It'd just be good to clarify exactly how that's happening and then look at prioritization of the road repairs up there. If they're degrading at this rapid a rate, then something different should be done.
And I'd like to know if since 2004, since you met the $3.5 million, is there no longer an agreement for
the agreement
fees
was to pay a certain amount to assist in the road impacts that were made.
Yeah.
So that doesn't expire. It was fulfilled.
Okay, and there, so there are no fees being collected anymore?
Other than what we would normally receive through the state contribution and the collection of taxes and so forth, that was saying fuel taxes.
Does any of that money go for windshields and paint jobs and dings?
Good question. I don't believe so.
Well, I was curious, just for clarification. So you're paying 2.5 cents on per ton. And that was from the start, from the moment you started hauling through 2014, and it wasn't on an annual basis that you paid, but it was said when you reached some threshold, this 300,000 tons or whatever it was, at that point it was one lump sum, you had met your obligation, that was a deal that was cut, and is there any revisiting that on the part of the county? I mean, it seems like an interesting way to go about this, like, given that the mine is going to continue beyond the time at which they were generating revenue, it's interesting that they didn't write a provision into that saying that the trucks are still rolling, the roads are getting, the state of disrepair, and we still need to keep the coffer open to help underwrite the cost of that.
So the scenario was an either or. It was you pay for the first 15 years at this rate or the first 3.5 million ton. So either or scenario. And the pit happened to get busy, and the obligation was met much sooner than the 15-year forecast.
So this conversation is a great segue into the forum, and one of the advantages we have here is of being able to have this discussion. So what we're using this information for is to inform staff, right? We need to know exactly what's going on out there because we will, in the future, have opportunities to review these CUPs and to create new CUPs and to make recommendations. And in the policymaking process, when council directs us to do something, to inform them about something, we, in many cases, have been limited in the amount of information we can acquire because the timing for those responses to council and our policymakers is in a box. It's a very short period of time. This forum gives us an opportunity from the surface mining operation perspective is to really do a good job of informing ourselves as to meaningful changes we can recommend for CUPs and operational aspects of CUP enforcement and accountability that can substantially change the way we do business and provide service and navigate these very difficult challenges associated with this operations. Not to say that we every recommendation that we make will be adopted, but it will be a recommendation we can make with a lot more information than we've had previously. And I can't tell you what happened 15 years ago when they researched the potential for operational impacts on the road surfaces up there. I don't know how big a survey was, but apparently they may have felt that this fee structure for the first 300,000 or 3.5 million tons was sufficient enough to meet that requirement.
Which brings up a really interesting point or two. And the first has to do with what is the longevity of a conditional use permit? And do they expire? And when do they expire? And two, can they be modified along the way if you're learning new things? And I think this exemplifies a pretty good example of that, that road deterioration continues, but the stipulations that were initially drafted haven't really necessarily served the community that well in the long haul.
Right. I agree. I mean, we wouldn't be here if they had.
But so the question is do we know how long these last, when they expire, and two, can they be modified along the way, and how does that amendment...
There are certain circumstances under which CUPs can be modified. One of those is when there's been a violation of some sort where the citation's been issued and the hearing examiner can order a revisitation of the CUP to address structural challenges that may deal with accountability or inspections or whatever the case may be. In that environment, though, again, staff is very limited in what kind of testimony we can give because we're testifying about a violation that occurred, limited to the evidence we've collected, specific. And what we can't do is go into a very substantial analysis of, the road surfaces and everything else and the impacts and all that. We have to kind of keep it in that box. Those circumstances come around fairly with fair frequency in the citation process. Not every one of those is going to result in a modification of a CUP. There's also the possibility that CUPs can be withdrawn if there's egregious violations.
Right. Well, I think this doesn't seem like there's a violation. It just seems that the county did not put, basically didn't put enough money into the conditional use permit to account for the degradation of the road.
What other businesses do the county impose fees on for accessing a public road system beyond what we've agreed to pay and have paid? Walmarts, people that generate a lot of traffic, that there's general wear and tear on the road.
Right, so right now we have our over legal limit program, permitting program.
We pay permits if we're overweight, if we're moving a wheel loader or something like that, and we're impacting the road system more than what's legal, we pay that.
Right.
But we're talking about legal loads now.
Right.
And imposing new restrictions and fees to be paid by accessing a public road system while being legal weight.
Right. The examples that I can give you are only limited to the special permits that are issued. It's very similar to your CUP. The over legal permit program is a special permit for moving a vehicle across a surface for a period of, for a distance. And you've got to pay that extra fee for it. But there's an expectation that we're going to have to do some traffic control and provide some assistance in that move, or at least be mindful of the fact that there's a concern with the size of the vehicle. If there are accidents, if there are incidents, there are always opportunities for us to pull the plug or to stop whatever's happening in order to mitigate the dangers. These types of things don't rise to that immediate level of threat, but they do, if you pointed out about the rocks and stuff flying off the vehicles, I mean, those are immediate impacts that can be mitigated in some instances. How we address that in a CUP, whether that recommendation will be adopted. I know at the hearing that there's a good number of people that will be there, along with you and staff. And how those things have turned out in the past is what we're dealing with now. Those are the CUPs that have been constructed to regulate this particular activity. I think there is a way to come to a reasonable understanding and mutual agreement about what is reasonable for operation of the surface mining in Clark County. How costly that's going to be for you can be determined a lot by the regulations that we put in place for the monitoring and everything else. But suffice it to say, there's an incentive for voluntary compliance. There's an incentive for this type of environment where we have an opportunity to come to agreements that can help you navigate some of the things that have been troublesome for your operation. And these are the folks that are most heavily vested in your success, in the sense that if you're successful, they're successful. But that success has to be mutually enjoyable. And that means that we can't go out and say, you know, because we are being impacted monetarily like this in operations, if we're pushed past the price point, it doesn't make this economically viable. We don't want to get to that point. What we do want to do is say, what can be done for you to really navigate these challenges and mitigate the impacts on the environment to the greatest extent possible, to a point where, as an example, we use the blasting schedules. If we think about publishing a blasting schedule for your particular operation, and everybody has access to that, and it's known to them in advance, then it's not a surprise, and it may still have the same effect. But you offered the monitors, the seismometers. You offered to talk about the potential for publishing the blasting schedules. Those are all things that can help resolve these complaints that may change the way we look at CUPs. Do we really need to address this with a heavy hand?
Those are things that were in the CUP.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is call and ask, and we can put a seismograph on your
right.
property.
The problem is we didn't have this public system of putting your CUP out for everybody to look at, and so they can see how it impacts them.
Yep.
This is something that's been encapsulated between two entities, the regulators and the operators,
yep.
and it hasn't been readily available to share with the public.
Yep.
This is really important, and this aspect is for us to be able to have a website where everybody that is interested in looking at the operational requirements, the impacts, the agreements, the stipulations that have been made, and even in the enforcement actions, the trip counts, everything that we can possibly do can be co-located in a single website for you to visit and for everybody to visit and to hold us accountable. We're the monitors, right? We have to monitor. In a minute, we'll go through some of the improvements that we've made in the last couple of weeks that will, I think, help people understand that we're moving forward with a lot of things that have been recommended so far. But I think it's important not to invalidate the value of your operation or any surface mining operation. But impacts being what they are at this time, and the number of complaints and the number of concerns that have been raised, give us an opportunity to find a way to. We're not here to negotiate a CUP. What we are here to do is inform each other and to find a common path forward. And yes, there may be costs associated with that, but we're not walking out of here with binding agreements any more than a handshake would give us. But that's an important aspect of this, is trust. And you've got to trust us. You have to trust us. We have to trust everybody here.
I just want to make sure that if there's potholes on Gabriel Road, there's also potholes throughout the county that aren't associated with the mining operations at the pit.
Right.
So if we're going to condense this to a mile radius from the pit and expect me as the operator to pay for that, because I think that's where the conversation was headed, or at least during the next conditional use permit, to impose those fees on myself, I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's reasonable.
I think that I agree. I don't think it's equitable. I think if you look at equitable delivery of service and equitable as it pertains to road maintenance in the county, we have to look at the high traffic areas. We have to concentrate and focus our attention on those things. You know, I worked in the oil field for years, and we were held accountable for every single inch we moved across people's property and had to restore it and make sure it was in great shape when we finished thumping the ground. We were held accountable for that, and we were held economically accountable for that if we messed up. We can monitor, but we like to monitor with common knowledge. Everybody understands what we're looking at. Everybody understands what you're doing. You understand what we're looking at.
I'm sorry.
Okay, just a bit more to say that we want to study the traffic, and I want to take a look at the capital facilities project and say, you know, is there a way to prioritize these? The citizens still deserve the good, safe roads. even if there is a mining operation that we permitted, that doesn't diminish the importance of that repair. Holding a mine accountable for that, as much as saying, well, over a period of time, this would degrade that much anyway. So we have an obligation to fix it. If that intended, stimulation that was provided back when you first hauled your first three and a half million tons, was to reinforce it to the extent it would be easier for us to maintain, easier for us to resurface. It would have a more robust construction. Did we achieve that objective? That's a great question.
And there are things that we were required to do that haven't been done yet. And the county's in a bad position because the county doesn't own a lot of right-of-way outside of the shoulder. And I know you know that.
Yep.
So that was the challenge of improving the intersection of Kelly Road and Lucia Falls, which we're on the hook to do, and we're ready, willing, and able to do that. But the county has to obtain right-of-way. That's why there's no shoulders or there's big shoulder drop-offs, because county doesn't own the land adjacent to it. So they can't extend those. They can't create wider lanes for truck traffic because they don't own the property, and they'd have to take it by eminent domain to get there. So there are obligations that we are on the hook for once the county obtains right-of-way at these certain intersections. But it can't be done because the county doesn't own the property. And it's a tough position for the county to be in.
Well, for example, there's a giant pothole in front of the Royal Ridges driveway. And as you drive down, you can see that where the truck's paths, as they swerve off, go to the Royal Ridges driveway and then make
the turn. I'm not familiar with Royal Ridges. Where's that at, really? Is it up
right
Kelly Road?
Where Gabriel Road meets Kelly Road.
That T intersection, the other side of the T, that's the Royal Ridges driveway.
Okay.
And so I think an example of something that would be fair, they probably wouldn't grant you access or permission to have their an offer to fill that pothole because it is deep and it is multiple potholes. I have to actually, to get in their driveway, I have to go all the way to the end where and go in where the opposing traffic comes out because it would just tear up my car. Extending an offer to fill it or make sure it's continually filled or even paving over that section because the trucks just constantly swerve to make the turn onto Gabriel would maybe be a nice offer or gesture.
In fact, Bo said something about the fairness. Fairness is a good deal, and you said you agree with me. I have to take slight exception. Nobody knows if it's fair. I don't know, and I think there's a real perception that heavily laden gravel trucks with trailers are a lot tougher on the road than just about any other sets of wheels that are going down there. And part of your introduction is that one of your missions is to advise the political side of the county who are in a position to do something about that if it's fair or unfair. But the knowledge of its fairness doesn't exist yet. And so the whole notion, and it's at least conceivably knowable, are gravel trucks a lot harder on roads than our Priuses? And everybody says yes, but to what extent? And is the fee structure that's set up by the political side in line with the usage and the damage structure that the various vehicles present? And until you get grips with that, you can't answer his question, and he doesn't know that for sure either. Nobody in the room knows if it's fair or not.
They are legal weights on the road system. They're not overweight by nature of the standard. So like a dump truck and pup combination, you'll have 8 axles, I'd say, on average. So among those 8 axles, you've got anywhere from 20 to 22 different tires across that wheelbase. Ours are average around 60 feet long. So it's to distribute the pounds per square inch on the roadway to limit the impacts that they have on those. Just like the bridge issue came up at the last hearing. And that's why the dump trucks aren't restricted on that bridge, because they have less pounds per square inch than certain emergency vehicles that are only sitting on 2 axles, but upwards of 40,000 pounds.
I guess the point here is, again, we're trying to deal with perceptions, whether they're accurate or not is something that, you know, nobody here knows yet. The perception is by a lot of people that the mine, the gravel trucks do a lot more damage, and that they're, in a sense, receiving a subsidy above and beyond what other road users use. I don't know that to be true. But nobody here can really say it's untrue, and I'm saying it's an opportunity to do something.
Can we agree that the roads, as they were originally constructed, were not intended for the type of traffic that they're getting?
That's exactly right. Sorry for interrupting, but I've talked to people in the public works, and those roads were not designed with the base to handle the trucks. Okay, so if you have a 100,000-pound truck and you got 22 axles, there's still more weight there than many of the cars. One of the engineers in the county told me one truck weighing 80 to 100,000 pounds is equal to 10,000 cars. So the problem is the base rock is not strong enough, and maybe you people haven't driven trucks like I have and worked on them, but when you're coming down the hills, it's the terrain. You have flat, it's not get flat ground, flat roads, it's not going to be beaten up as bad. But braking with that load and the trailers, just look at it. That's where you see the weak parts in the road. And they came and they repaired it, and they spent over $200,000-something in October. And most of those spots need repairing again. Already. Why? You're going to keep putting the Band-Aids on because the base needs to be redone. And it's going to be a big cost, and somebody told me it's going to be in the millions. This is a county person for 2020.
The frequency and the volume of the traffic, there's 200-400 trucks a day, potentially, if they're going at the allowable trips. Yeah. On that stretch of road.
I
can probably give a lot of information in reference to weights, bridges on trucks, and different things that maybe help you a little bit. So under Title 4, RCW, and I can't get on my phone, that's why I've been trying to play with it. I don't know if we could do it on the screen. 46.17.355, that actually breaks down the tonnage for pounds and how much the truck will pay.
Could you say that again?
Yes, 46.17.355 is an RCW. So just like everybody's noticed more and more with the EOL, they're actually attaching tonnage to your cars now. And so they do that for every vehicle. So with his trucks, and you have a bridge on your truck, so there's a distance between the front axle to any set of axles or from the front to the very rear. So so that's one way of potentially getting problems with weights. It's tire factors. It's actually also in reference to axles themselves and the size of the tires. So there's many ways to actually get in trouble, by being overweight. So I do work. So I'm the commercial vehicle deputy. I work all the mines. I haven't been able to spend as much time as I'd like, but I've actually been up at Colt quite a bit ever since Livingston was shut down. The traffic has increased, obviously. Staying in the middle, because I'm protecting both sides, and that's what I do, is that they actually do pay quite a bit of road tax. And if you look at that on the schedule, I wish I could have brought it up, is they do pay quite a bit on the road tax. I'm not saying it justifies the pit being there. That was over my head. I'm just asked to enforce the rules. And so one of the things that I do respond is when folks email me, and I've noticed an uptick in reference to complaints, but a lot of the times when I ask what the complaint is or what laws they're citing, I don't get a very good response, and it's maybe that perception where they think it's illegal, but it may or may not be. And so I try to help get that information out, and obviously any one person in here can email me. I've been contacted by many folks at all of the rock quarries. So every vehicle is going to be different. I'm not an engineer. I would disagree on the 10,000 vehicles for that one truck. But again, I know a little bit more. I could sit here and do you a little bit of an engineering class and whatnot, but you don't have enough time for that.
I can't help but to – thank you. That was interesting to hear. I can't help but to imagine that if one were to spend a couple of hours delving in, that they would find a very rich literature on the topics of the relative influence that passenger cars versus pickup trucks versus all the way up to these trucks have. So
sure.
I don't think there's a dearth of information. I think we're operating in a vacuum around the circle right now or square, but those data are out there, and we just need to find them.
Yes, we do. But what are we going to do with it? One of the things that I'm hearing here is that, these potholes are occurring with a lot of frequency, and because of the amount of use of the roads, do we have a mechanism by which we can report potholes as soon as we see them, and for early intervention? Do we have a pothole hotline?
Yes,
we do.
Yes, there's a website on Public Works that you can report.
Can we put a link to it on this website?
Yes,
okay. Can we report stretches of road?
You may.
Well, or just make 46 reports.
Yeah, but, you know.
That pothole's a static event. Once it's there, it's there. So somebody can go back and find it. How about a day like today when it's raining as hard as it was, a mother is taking two kids in the backseat of her car into town, following a truck, gets hammered by a stone that came off that wheel. Now what does she do? Tell me, what happens? Is she going to pull that guy over on the side of the road? Is that guy going to get out of his cab? And he's going to say, no, it wasn't. And then what? And it's over and over and over again. And that's just that time. There's all sorts of things that go on out there, at least where we're at. And it's just, it's outrageous because there's no oversight. There's nothing. It just happens and you're done. You're going to take somebody to court for that? But it happens all the time, and there's no end in sight.
Right.
If anything, it's getting worse.
Well, a mandate on covering loads.
Right.
I don't mean to interrupt in reference to a lot of it. Please understand the laws. So there is not a mandate to cover a load as long as they meet the free board on the truck. So if they have 6 inches all around, and they can be as high as a pyramid it can be, as long as it meets the state requirement. Now, it also goes to what fines are in there, and if it's sand, if it's dry, there's a lot of factors. So when you cite these, and again, I'm just to protect everyone and so they're informed, I can give you a lot of these statutes, and it will help beforehand before the perception gets and folks get upset. So unfortunately, with the liability in reference to rock cracks, it happens. Unfortunately, it happens. I've been, my patrol vehicles actually had rocks hit it, but it was from passenger vehicles too. So I totally get. I've been on your roads. I work it all the time, and so I don't live there. And I'm. But I just want you to know when you reference to certain things, I'm more happy intervene in reference to what the laws are, because I can only enforce what laws on the books.
And make a remark. Could be wrong, but I believe the original conditional use permit said that those trucks had to be covered.
Anything that's smaller than 5/8 minus, right. It did say that in there.
So what are you hauling right now?
We don't haul anything smaller than 5/8 minus. We don't make a 3/8 minus or quarter minus or anything like that. And the reason for that was it would be considered an unsecured load if you're blowing fines off the back of the truck.
Sure, sure.
But there is a difference between a rock falling off a rig and breaking a windshield, and that's happened before. We've had our gauge trip, and rock will spill out, and I'll be the first one to fix a windshield. But if it comes out of the tire, unfortunately, that is considered a road hazard, and it's something that an insurance is supposed to fix. Or a glass repair company will fix and bill your insurance, and your premiums won't go up because it's considered a road hazard. Nobody's fault. Because you can pick up rocks off the road just like a passenger vehicle can.
But if the road is breaking down,
yeah.
When a dually comes along, it picks it up, it carries it maybe just a little ways, and then it flies out with a lot of force.
You get drilled with rocks out on Interstate 5, and those rocks aren't breaking down. It picks up. If it can fit the tread and it picks it up, it's going to shoot it out the backside.
I understand that, but if it's, where the road's deteriorated, it'll catch between the dualies.
Sure.
And then it'll be a bigger rock that'll fly,
yep.
More force.
So, go back to just a quick point that the deputy made about enforcing the laws. I think part of the challenge is with CUP, they're not laws, but they're an agreement. And so how do you enforce an agreement of road trips, for example, if there aren't, you're not allowed to have 30, more than 30 truck trips in an hour? How do you enforce that? How do you monitor that? Because at times it seems like it's well over 30 an hour. I've been on Lucia Falls Road and 503, and I've seen 15 trucks one after the other, or within a 10-minute span, making their way up to the quarry. So that would tell me that way more than 30 trucks in an hour.
So we're going to take care of that.
One of the things the CUV does is set aside the number of trips and volume of trips per hour. We'll be, of course, we receive the reports, the spreadsheets from the operator, and we're going to utilize a mobile trailer that we have that was provided by Homeland Security with a camera on it. We're going to refurbish it, put it out there, and use it to periodically in all our operations to use it as a method of reconciling on a without announcement, reconciling the trip counts, having the officer that we're hiring, by the way, we're recruiting for a code enforcement officer whose job will be to monitor surface mining compliance and CUPs with frequency, and to look at these videos and to look at the spreadsheets and verify that there is the limits aren't being exceeded.
And this isn't the first time the county's offered that position either. I mean, we've had a code enforcement officer in the county before,
yep.
Ben Joner, and he understood the CUP. He knew it front to back,
yep.
And he lived at Livingston Quarry and Mountaintop Quarry, and he'd show up unannounced, and I think he was employed a full calendar year,
yeah.
And we didn't know when he was coming, but we know what the rules are,
yep.
And he didn't issue one single citation. So it's not like the county has just been turning a blind eye to our operations up there. There has been efforts to hire code enforcement officers to enforce the CUP.
Well, this time, we're replacing Ben.
Yep.
And unfortunately, there has been a lapse, and it was generated a lot by the resourcing challenges we had. We had to dedicate it to the priority, and the priority was not the surface mining compliance. Hence, we're here. But moving forward, we're going to solve that problem. We expect, and the CUP drives the conditions under which the operation occurs, right? And it sets the standards and compliance requirements. We expect voluntary compliance. It really isn't, the whole idea is to say, here's the conditions under which you can operate. And this is safe. And if you exceed those conditions, then you'll be held accountable. Well, we have to have a mechanism to be able to demonstrate that violation has occurred, but at the same time, we have to have a resource to reconcile and ensure that the community is fully advised as to what's going on. If there's been, you can examine the same information we look at and make your own conclusions with it. But it gives us an opportunity and a starting point for that conversation versus us having to dash up with a code enforcement officer after the truck traffic is the stop for the day. Ideally, we wouldn't issue a violation notice because everything is managed well. There can't be an expectation, I think, that we'll get every rock, but there could be a possibility for a street sweeping device with a frequency. Are the streets over there ever swept?
No. We legally can't go down and sweep a county road.
Understandable.
Yeah.
Understandable. Is that something we would think about? If we have if the objective is to minimize the amount of impacts on vehicles, if we get reports over a period of time that there's, a large concentration of rock on the streets and we're going up there and having to remove it, there's a real possibility we're going to look and say, where is this stuff coming from?
Oh, yeah, and if we have a spill, I mean, regardless if it comes out of one of our
sure.
trucks, if we know it came out of the quarry, we're on that to go get it off the road.
So
we have pickups running all over the county, and you call two of them, and I'll be one of them, grab a shovel, and head up there because we spilled.
Okay. Is that information available to the folks in the area?
No.
Can it be?
How should I do that?
Give it to us and let us post it on the website.
If we have somebody trips their gates and has a spill, and we
right.
go up and...
So anytime there's an impact in the community as a result of the operation, is there a mechanism by which the community members can pick up the phone and call the mine operator and say, hey, this just happened in front of us. Looks like the truck kept
going. You mean
going.
To call us direct, not me tell everybody that, hey, one of our trucks just spilled.
No, call you directly and say,
yeah,
hey, we got a problem. Can you come
I
take care
of it? I just created an email address for Mountaintop. It's mountaintop@stordahl.com. I hear it takes 6 hours to take effect. I did it about noon today, so it should be ready to go. And I created one for Livingston at stordahl.com also.
Are those the two you sent us?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Mountaintop, what do you call it? Yakko Mountain?
Mountaintop, yep. Mountaintop@stordahl.com.
One thing we learned in our situation with respect to this, the emails, which I think is a great way to, I mean, that's a start. But there are people up there who were not even aware that the mine was going in or attempted to, the permitting and all that stuff. they just didn't have, they don't have computers. They're just a different generation. It's not a universal thing. And bless their hearts, they had no clue this was going on. So we did a Paul Revere to let them know what was going on. Mm-hmm. So this other stuff, they just don't have the energy to chase this stuff down.
Well, part of the work of the code enforcement officer is going to be outreach, and the expectation that you visit the communities, you work with the neighborhood associations, the representative communities inside to make sure those words get out in spite of their communication, you know, the method.
Does that position have authority and responsibility?
Yes.
What kind of authority?
So they're an enforcement officer. They can write citations. They can stop work. They can halt activity that is causing a problem.
And you said both that you had one already?
The county did.
And they did not write one citation?
Not a single citation.
The existence of an enforcement officer probably encourages compliance.
And that's a... I think that's an accusation. If I break the rules, I can get shut down.
Yep.
Nobody knows what the rules are better than I do. We've made mistakes before, and I'll be the first one to get on the phone and call up my cousin or my little brother and say, what are you doing? Here's what the rules are. Don't start 15 minutes early. Don't start 30 minutes early because we're behind. We have rules up here. So the fact that just because code enforcement was hired for a year, and I think it was about 2-3 years ago that happened, we don't like breaking the rules because we don't like getting in trouble. And I know that people think that, yeah, when no one's watching them, they just go out there like cowboys and Indians and do whatever they feel like doing. That's not the case. You can't survive in this industry operating that way. You're too heavily regulated to just do whatever the hell you want.
Well, it's too costly to...
You can't afford to do that.
Right. Yeah, we understand that.
We're not stupid. You know, we've been in business for 50 years this August.
Interesting points have come up, I think. One from Mitch and the other from Bo. Mitch was saying how the desire is to have information that's shared. And that is consistent with the criteria laid out in the conditional use permit. There's two issues, I think, at least that I'm feeling and other people may be aware of, too. One is having a clear understanding of what is really written out in the conditional use permit about starting times, about number of trips, and does any of that just exist in one place in a table? And if not, can we have a condensed version of that?
Yes.
So that's the first point. The second point, and it'd be very interesting to know what data are being collected and is there oversight? So, for example, it's my understanding, Bo, that you guys are allowed roughly 5,000 gallons of water a day. I'd like to know...
Stormwater.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry?
Stormwater.
Okay. So, does any... So, how about being pumped up from the ground?
We don't... We're hooked up to city water at the pit.
Okay. Entirely. And that's all metered then?
It's all metered.
Okay.
For dust control...
You're hooked up to city water?
Yeah. It was expensive. But
that's a big tank up there, isn't it? The big reservoir.
It's a big pump. Wow. You get it up the hill. Yeah. But yeah, we buy city water and it's metered. Because at 5,000 gallons a day, that's a tank of water. Mm-hmm. And in the summertime, you can't do dust control with a tank of water a day. And we have to have dust suppression on our crusher tube fog nozzles. So everything's plumbed right into a tank. We draw off that tank to fill up our water trucks and do dust suppression on the crusher. But we buy city water. We plumbed it clear up the mountain.
Yeah, do you do dust control on the blasting?
No.
You don't?
No.
Is there a reason for it, or?
There's no way to do it. Unless you, I shouldn't say that. You could check with the blasting company to see if there's a different powder that has suppression in it, mm-hmm. but I know that they do their damnedest to make sure that there isn't, they limit all impacts. But yeah, you can't hose down an area and then light it off and it's all just raw material that's coming out of the hill.
I have some notes from the Southwest Washington Clean Air Agency on that. I've got a couple of pictures here of blasts. First one, it says, your photo leads me to believe that they are exceeding their permit limit regarding opacity of emissions, as this is clearly a situation with 100% opacity for a good part of a minute, and the limit is that they can't exceed 10% opacity for more than 3 minutes. And the timestamp there is 5 minutes. I didn't realize I should keep shooting pictures. And From a general air quality perspective, the pit is required to prevent unreasonable amounts of fallout from impacting neighboring properties such that they cannot be used or enjoyed. Southwest Washington 400-040, parentheses 2. And then the other general air quality avenue by which your issue can be addressed is the requirement to prevent emissions detrimental to persons or property, Southwest Washington Clean Air Agency 400-040, in quotes 5. This requirement states that no person could cause or permit the emission of any air contaminant from any source if it is detrimental to the health, safety, and welfare of any person or causes damage to property or business. And we have reports from people that, I mean, the blasts are rattling them. They're shaking our foundation. People have had their wood piles fall over. I mean, it's that much of a blast. Just a couple weeks ago, someone had to go inside of their house because it was so bad. And the blast, there were two blasts that week that they had to do that. So.
And it was just, so they went inside their house.
Because of the dirt.
Because of the
coming.
Dirt.
Yeah.
Do you use dynamite or do you use that pre-mix?
It depends on, I'm not an expert on it.
It depends
for
on
good
the
reason, because I would be terrible with explosives.
The type of rock, too. When you're in hard rock, you're going to use the dynamite, which you can't
it's
control
not
as well.
I know that for a
okay.
I will check with them if there's a way to limit the dust, but the key sentence I read out of that Southwest Clean Air does do is no emission of an unreasonable amount. So if it can't be controlled, but blasting is necessary to extract, that's something that Southwest Clean Air has never taken issue with at any one of our quarries in our history, is dust from the blast. It's strictly on dust control in the pits, something that can be controlled, something that can be maintained, and that they make sure that we make every effort going forward to maintain that dust.
Do they provide you monitors to measure, like, the opacity?
No, but they come in when we install a crushing system. We have to have each unit permitted, and they come in and do an opacity test, and I've submitted this information to Clark County.
Okay.
But once you install a new crushing system, they come up and do an inspection and make sure that you are in compliance with that. And then they'll do any, and every year you pay them for dust that you likely would have put off into the air. You pay a fee to Southwest Clean Air, and it's all based on tons sold. And then they'll come up and do routine inspections.
Would you be willing to post those reports on the website?
Which reports?
The opacity reports, the Clean Air Authority reports.
I've already given them to Clark County, and I can resend them.
No, do you mind if we post them?
Sure.
Okay.
I thought that's what you were going to do when you guys asked for them. The public's asking for this stuff, so that's why I gave them.
Yeah, no, great. Yeah, I mean, the whole idea is to, again, is let people draw their own conclusions.
Sure.
One of the things that you'll find out, and this is, I've been in a regulator for 25 years, and we don't always have the right rules to work with. We don't always have the right rules. Things change over time. Technology changes. Circumstances change. And we sometimes find ourselves working with outdated and antiquated and for the most part, ineffective rules. And it's okay for us to look at that and have that evaluation and say, what we're doing now may have worked previously, but it doesn't work the same way now because something's changed. This is a good opportunity for us to say, look, as a surface mining operator, if there are all these controls in place that you're currently complying with and it still is resulting in challenges, what adjustments can be made? What can we do to identify this? And if the Clean Air Authority is interested enough to do a yearly monitoring, perhaps they could be more frequent or they could come up and look at individual events. You know, I mean, these pictures are fine, but you sent them to the authority, right? And they rendered that decision saying it looks like it might have been different if they'd been there with their monitors.
We talked last meeting, too, about inviting state-level sorts of folks. I think this conversation brings that right back. That I would like to suggest that one of the high priorities would be the Southwest Clean Air Authority people. Come in and speak to some of these things. Because, you know, once again, we can all talk around it, but none of us, you know, are particularly expert at it, as near as I can tell.
I see a distinct need for another meeting at the very least, and I think I'd like to invite them. And as we continue this conversation tonight, let's think about others we can invite to help help guide the conversation, or at least inform the conversation. I think that would be beneficial.
Can we add a clean water authority? Yes. Is there one of those out there?
And yes. Public health authorities.
Okay, let's get the experts. Public health?
Yeah.
Do we have a specific?
Morganite, and silica.
Okay.
Yeah. I have test results.
That's the next question I have. Did you do those yourselves? I mean, did you hire a scientist or technician?
So what happened is the dust has been different at our house, and something has bothered me about it. In last August, hearing someone mention Morganite at one of the hearings, I started thinking something's wrong here. And so I did. I had a scientist come to the house and do an analysis. And So I have two test results to give you. This scientist came back a second time because he was surprised at what he was finding, and this is orionite, which is known as naturally woolly orionite, which is known as naturally occurring asbestos. And the American Geosciences Institute does the best layman's term write-up about this. I have a whole list, actually. Similar to regulated asbestos, the fibrous shape of the... There's studies in North Dakota and Turkey that are easy to find online that are scientific controls over time, where they've found the death rate 33 to 45.5%. Mesothelioma from a quarry in the area. See, this is found naturally in volcanic soils. It's not a problem until it gets blasted in the air or blows off the trucks. We have pictures of the dust coming off of the trucks, and I know people have experienced it themselves, been in cars behind with the dust coming off. Excuse me, I'm not a public speaker, but here is... This is Morganite and silica found from the trucks coming off out of Yakult Quarry.
Can I ask, the sample that was collected, where was that collected from? And
I have that written down.
The one we did?
Yeah. Was it taken off your driveway where dust had settled? Or
my
where?
Kitchen counter.
No, it was in the house.
My kitchen counter.
So getting through the air systems.
Getting through the filters. Both scientists, separate scientists, you'll see at the end of that report, and a specialist I go to are deeply concerned not only for the families around, but for the employees and their families. And you'll see it in the back of that report because the dust is contaminated.
The people that are closer to the mine than yourself
have
a much higher concentration.
And I think the certified study was done closer to the mine.
Oh, yes.
The purpose of ours, we wanted to know what was in that dust. And
we did not expect to find orionite.
So we had that done to see whether it was worth pushing at a forum like this for more testing. We're not saying, okay, this study is, you know, the end all. You know, we need it, it's not it's the beginning. It's just to show that it's very likely that independent testing would find the same thing.
So I have a
but
question.
That one is independent, yeah. That you have in front of you there.
Yeah, it is. So I have a question. I mean, the operator has the same has an obligation to protect the people that work in the operation, and has to ensure that they're protected for any type of airborne particulate that may create a problem for them. Do you periodically monitor the air quality inside the pit itself?
It's tested inside the cab while the employees are working.
Okay.
It's all about exposure. And okay. If they're on the ground, they're not in the cab, they wear a standard mask that LNI recommends.
So they're wearing masks out there while they're working.
If they're like right in the, you know, nuts and bolts of the crushing unit, where it's the most condensed.
The cartridge mats, they're just the little white ones.
Just the little white ones.
Well, those are not as effective as the cartridge ones.
Those won't work on this, I apologize, but my doctor specifically...
You're making the assumption that it's there, and we don't know that it's there, and...
That was the next question.
I'd like us to find out.
Can I make a suggestion? I think what really has to happen, I think Bo brought up a good point, saying you have dust in your house, you're a couple of miles away, well, that dust could have come from anywhere. I mean, really, to get at this... You have to collect dust from the plume at the time a shot's going off and also have collectors around at different distances that coincide with the time of a blast, and then you build that story based on those data that are collected at the time of an explosion, and you're watching a deposition come down. And so that's really the way to get at this. This is a good starting point, as you both have alluded
that's
to, but ultimately... I think, in all fairness to everyone, you need to be collecting dust from the plume and look at the composition.
I think that's the biggest challenge, though. And I said at last meeting, what if Mortonite is present? And what if we're making every effort we can to suppress that dust? What levels are safe? What levels are unsafe?
Good questions.
There isn't data on that to point the finger and say that you're having an adverse effect on the community because of this. If you're making every conscious effort to suppress that dust, the one way to extract that rock from the ground, what is that data going to tell everybody? What narrative is going to be created once that data is in front of everybody's face that, to be frankly, not everybody in this room, but some people would just rather that pit not be there? So starts this...
Looking at it objectively, in all honesty, I mean, you think about... what would be done? That's a great question. What would be done if there was found to be concentrations of Mortonite or silica or any contaminant out there that would be considered a health hazard? And how would you mitigate that? I know from my experience in construction that I used to have wheel baths, so I would not take any sediment out from my construction site onto a road or a paved surface. That was a requirement. The wheel baths had to be robust, and they had to be maintained, and they had to be clean, and I had a certain aggregate in there the whole bit. What would it look like if, in fact, there was contamination on your site? Would it shut the mine down, or would it simply require mitigation, where you would have like a spray rig that every truck leaving the site would have to go under beforehand that would wet down the load to the extent you could not get airborne particulate over a certain period of time? As an example, and just to answer your question. How?
And both comments presuppose that it's going to show there's a bunch of this stuff out there. The flip side of that is you do the test and it says it's not there.
Right.
And then you're in that dimension, you're home free.
And regardless of the outcome, I mean, if it turns out that it's negative, okay, that Mortonite silica is almost certain. Silica is in all rock, nearly all rock. And woolly or rhinite is there. And there are no current levels that are invoked, right, in terms of parts per million per unit area of air volume or something like that. Regardless of that, regardless of how you might mitigate or regulate, the people need to know, like Marie's bringing up. We just need to know, and the citizens deserve that. It's the government's job in part to help facilitate obtaining that information when you know, the flag has gone up. And so knowledge is powerful. Knowledge is important. We can take responsibility for ourselves, even if it's not something that you can act regulatorily on.
I totally agree. In fairness to the community, if there's, I mean, a hazard to one person may not be a hazard to someone else. We have neighbors with severe asthma.
Yes.
I think it's fair that they know what's in the air they're breathing. They can communicate that with their doctor.
They're worried.
In our case, we invested thousands of dollars in air filtration systems because we're not going to sit there and keep breathing based on what we know about what our scientific tests showed. That's fair to us to know that it's there. It's fair to the whole community. Worst case, somebody might decide to go live someplace where there's not a quarry. Move someplace where there's clean air.
Yeah, even
you've got to give people that choice.
Yes, and I'd like to.
Thank you.
our situation is that the mine that is being proposed is going to get dropped next to a house that's 900 feet. 900 feet from that, and those people become guinea pigs.
Sure.
The moment this happens, well, there's a debate about what is it, how much, and all that other stuff. Can you imagine living there in that circumstance? It's not like it's been an established thing. They've been living there for 12 years, and the next thing you know, boom, not only is that mine going right next to them, they're going to put the road right next to their house. So they don't get to start their day when they want. It's when the mine starts. And who's going to be there to watch to make sure it starts and does all these things properly?
Are you folks from Cowlitz County?
Yes, we are.
Yeah. And are you talking about the pit that's being proposed in Cowlitz County?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That has nothing to do with Clark County here.
I agree. I agree. And that's why I mentioned that. That's why I put that out there.
Okay.
So but I think
it has nothing to do with me
either. We appreciate that. But right. I would, just with respect to their concerns, I mean, this is, I think this forum gives them an opportunity. This, I don't think this exists in Cowlitz County that I'm aware of.
No, it doesn't.
So
it's starting to.
Okay, good. But you know, for
and I looked at that pit and I passed on it because there's houses right next to it.
Thank
that's
you.
The worst thing that you can sign yourself up for is right next door to a rock pit. You know,
which is
we're
a
talking
that's
right
a generous thing to say, and I appreciate that. And we want you to understand we're not trying to shut down progress at all. But don't plunk it in our punch bowl.
But that's always the challenge, though, with the rock pit is. There's going to be impacts. Everybody knows that. But, and we've gone around Cowlitz County, Lewis County, Clark County, Sumania County, looking for places for the perfect setting for rock pit. Number one, does that place exist? And number two, is there rock in the ground at that location?
Right.
It never works out that way. So you look at, you find the rock first, and then you look at, here's the impacts that we're going to have. Can they be mitigated reasonably? And that's the first thing that we look at before we even start negotiating to the landowner or anybody, is can we mitigate these? But I want to make sure that mitigation is possible,
right?
Because rock pits are going to offend anybody, anywhere.
Right, and that's why I think we're all here, because we feel as though, as hard as you have tried, you haven't been able to mitigate to the satisfaction of the neighborhood and the community members. And,
right.
And everything I'm hearing is like, you've given it a hell of a try. But,
and I hope that's possible to satisfy, but I don't know that that is true.
Well, I'm just wondering if now, granted, you're in this up to your earlobes right now in terms of investment. I get that. But I'm just wondering, you've mentioned, Bo, how you've been to a lot of counties, you've been scouting out looking for places, and I don't know what's going on up on the federal land, but I think about the Gifford Pinchot right up the road. And, boy, no one lives up there, okay? I mean, you know, I've been there for 26 years, and, you know, all of a sudden I'm hearing a crusher every day. And it's tough, man. It's tough having that happen. And I'm just wondering if the federal lands can be looked at as a source. And I know that's getting a little far afield from the conversation, but
it's not, though. It's realistic. But it all comes down to, I can't just go and say, there's a good spot for a rock pit, and then go to the federal government and say, let me go mine that.
Well,
and it has to be in the surface mining overlay of the county to even be designated to even go out.
I understand that, but I mean, they're putting in a mine up on the Green River you've probably heard about, just north of St. Helens, right? They're doing exploratory drilling,
mm-hmm.
And believe me, I'm not an advocate of that by any stretch, okay? It's right on the Green River, but I'm simply saying that there's lots of, I believe there to be lots of mineral opportunities on the forest. It diffuses this whole problem. Right, we need aggregate as a society, mm-hmm. But on the other hand, no one wants it in their backyard.
Right.
And you know, no fault of yours, not accusing, but you know, your family business has come and dropped one right in our backyard, and it's been a tough little jagged pill to swallow. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been tough.
Yep.
We'd really like, and you know, at the end of the day, to find some reasonable solutions that everybody can live with, and to answer some of these really tough questions.
Question for the county, not specific to Yackel, but just in general. So, we know some of the people here, some of the issues that are facing other parts of the county. The common theme goes right back to conditional use permits, and you control that process. I mean, you personally actually control that process. You know, the hearing examiners work for community development. You hire them on contract. One of the serious problems there's been is that there's not continuity between the opinions that have been rendered by the various hearing examiners over time. Sometimes in adjoining quarries there are contradictory CUPs where the provisions don't mesh very well. I don't want to get into the specifics about it. I want to get your opinion about how this process could work better. So, one, do we have the right people working as hearing examiners for Clark County hearings? The same people have been there for a while and have created something of a mess across the county. Two, could you talk a little bit about, it was raised earlier, time bars on conditional use permits. In some cases in the county, there's a requirement or a provision for a first-year annual review followed by a 3-year annual review. In a certain number of cases, those annual reviews by the hearing examiner in the county have not taken place. They've been replaced by Type 1 land use decisions that have been made without public notice. What happens is after the initial concern about a quarry being permitted in a certain area, the operators of the county come back in and sort of more or less off the record because the heat's gone. Nobody's aware that's going on. Some provisions are made to change the number of trucks in one instance from 16 trucks to 180 trucks, 190 trucks. This sort of happens over time and nobody much notices it. Could you talk about how you get a handle on that as the person who's the senior code enforcement officer? How would you like to see that process work? So you have continuity across reviews of proposed uses, whether it's surface mining or not, and the continuing, here are the issues, the conditions are changing, and the permits don't change, and none of them seem to be sunsetted.
Wow. we've got 10 minutes left.
We spent a lot of time sort of poking at the operator.
I think poking at the regulator is a good thing to do. So that's how we get better, right? We question our processes. We question our procedures. We question our decision-making. And this is necessary in this process. This is essential. This is something I've been doing since I arrived here and received this mantle of community development director, is taking a real hard look at our processes and determining whether or not they're effective, determining whether or not they're equitable, determining whether or not they actually work the way they were intended to do. And it's a beautiful question and a great foundation, but to answer it and to encapsulate an answer that tries to make sense of that is, as we move through this process, we inform that process. And we go back and are able to say to our hearing examiners, our land use planners, hey, these are essential aspects of this business that need to be considered when we're informing these decisions or informing this policy. It's okay for us to say we need to change. It's just sometimes really difficult for regulators to admit that and to say, geez, you know, this doesn't work any longer. We like to kind of stick with the way things are. It's nice and comfortable, you know. But this isn't comfortable. If it were comfortable, we wouldn't be here. And so to respond in totality, I'd like to be able to look into some of these processes to tell you I'm committed to doing that, looking at and evaluating our processes and making sure that the objectives that we're and the needs of the community are being met across the spectrum of decisions that we have to make and the policies that we make. And if the policies need to be reviewed and amended, then that's what we'll do.
I like all of that. And what I would say is, in talking to people, especially involved in Yakult and some other areas, it's clear that most people don't understand how the system really works. They don't understand what a CUP really is all about. They don't understand the difference between testimony that's in the record. They don't understand the difference between the decisions and the findings. They don't understand what's enforceable under the state law or the county regulation. Nobody understands anything about the Clark County surface mining law, which is not enforced in any, because everything's grandfathered and preceded at the time of those provisions. One thing you might want to be thinking about is revisiting the Clark County law for surface mining in addition to the State Surface Mining Act, which is not enforced. The sheriff, you know, God bless him, he's a great sheriff, but the sheriff has sent me a letter saying he will not enforce the Surface Mining Act of the state of Washington because he considers it to be a regulatory matter, not to be a legal matter, even though the violation of it is a gross misdemeanor, which has serious daily penalties. The legislature passed the state law that had serious teeth, which is not being enforced. Neither the Attorney General of the state of Washington, the prosecuting attorney of the county that we're in, nor the sheriff will enforce the Surface Mining Act. You can operate a surface mine in the county, Clark County, without having a valid surface mining permit because no law enforcement official will regulate it, will enforce it. I have a piece of paper from the sheriff and from the prosecuting attorney saying that. The overall regulatory scheme needs work, but mostly at this point in this kind of forum, you need to devote some time. My suggestion, I don't mean to be dictating, my suggestion is there is a need for someone to sit down and explain how the CUP process works and what it means and what's enforceable and what's not enforceable. We are all affected by, you know, stones coming out of towers and tires and sand blowing off rigs going across the river into Oregon and all that stuff. But the CUP is a different kind of regulatory beast than the enforcement on the road. You know, Deputy Narimark doesn't have the authority to enforce most of the things that we impact on a daily basis in the environment of the surface mining in the county. And it's not his fault. It's just that's the way the laws are. You know, he can look at safety on rigs. You know, he can make sure people have their brakes inspected every once in a while. But, you know, he's not going to be there when he sees a truck blow through a red light. You know, it's just not going to happen. And that's not what this is really all about. We're talking about reasserting the control and proper regulation of an industry that a lot of people think is impacting their communities. And it's that regulatory framework that the citizens need to understand and need to think about how to give input to change it in a way that helps the community.
Sure. I completely agree with you. So one of the ideas that I heard earlier tonight was a Reader's Digest condensed version of the CUP and what it's intended to do and to capture some of those things and to put it up for everybody to look at and make their assumptions. But I think having one of our land use attorneys here to actually explain the CUP process would be beneficial to everybody. I think that's a great idea.
I don't want the county getting a bad rep. There is an extremely lengthy process for the conditional use permit and to open up a rock pit. I mean, these things don't just happen. You don't just get granted new loads or trips with a conditional use permit or a change in that without proper notice and a very lengthy process to get to that point.
So this is one of the fundamental changes that's occurred in this process is that mine operations last for many decades, and the folks that were initially around when those CUPs were applied for and received that notice have a lot of them are no longer around, but a good bunch of them were never given an opportunity to weigh in, right? They were never given an opportunity to comment or react.
It's slightly worse than that, because if you were not on the record at the process of the hearing examiner, you don't have standing to appeal anything that comes out of, right, of the decision of the hearing examiner. They're all gone.
Right. So then we think about how the regulatory body works. So what could we put in place to make this more equitable for all the residents around there? Could we have, in a CUP, could we structure periodic check-ins and reviews that would give that voice to everybody there, even the new arrivals, and help inform their decisions and inform them about what's going on in their environment? I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to ask. I really don't. It's no different than you wanting to go to your kid's school and find out, you know, what the teachers are teaching. You know, you have that right as a parent to figure out that your kids are getting the best education. We and the citizens of Clark County still have a very big interest in what's going on in their environment. And if they can find a way to address those things, by all means. But they turn to the regulators for a lot of that, and they say, well, the laws are being broken, or the rules are being broken, you need to fix this. Regulation by its nature is very slow moving. Policy is very slow moving. A lot of debate back and forth, and then a decision is made, then agreements are made, then you put it in place, and the jurisdiction is hoping, beyond hope, that
once the regulation's in place, everybody's going to abide by it, and you won't have to spend a lot of resource going out there trying to enforce it. It doesn't necessarily work that way, though. And we do a lot of enforcement. The efficacy of that enforcement is directly related to the amount of strength we have in the rules in themselves. And right now, surface mining is based on, when did we adopt this, Greg? Do you?
I don't remember it. Hope probably knows when the new surface mining was. It preceded all the current properties.
I think it did.
The surface mining adoption?
Yeah, when they gave us, when DNR said, you guys adopt your rule, we're just going to do reclamation.
Well, I think that was under, was that when GMA happened?
I believe so. That's correct. 96 about that. So, right. So how long have you been operating?
Our business has been 50 years, but we've been in Clark County for 35.
How long have you been at Yakko Mountain?
9 years.
9 years? Yeah. Okay. How many residents have moved into that area in 9 years?
I don't know that.
Guess what? I think I do, because we have all the development permits that we've issued up there for the residences. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we've ever sat down and looked at that compilation of the aggregation of the permitted activity up there saying, wow, there's a whole bunch of new folks arriving up there. Is there an opportunity for early education that will help inform them as to what's going on so they're not surprised by these things? Because we don't know that in the property transaction or property acquisition process that somebody said, hey, by the way, there's a surface mining operation located 2 miles away from you. You're going to hear periodic explosions. But they're doing a good job of managing it. You're going to see truck traffic up here in case you didn't know. We don't know that those disclosures are made, and the testimony that we do have from folks is that when they bought their place, it wasn't disclosed to them.
Right.
To interrupt, I agree with you. In Oregon, I had to do a full disclosure, not just about mines, but about other things. Right. And I tried to get it written into the code when we were redoing this, 2013 or 14,
right.
The county code, but it didn't go in. And there's things that have been left out, and so the code has flaws.
So it may, but is this something that we could look to an agreement with the community, with the operators, with the community members, the organizations, is saying, what can we do to support early education of people that are moving into the area and to give them the expectation and knowledge that they need to make good decisions? Having a website where you can go and Google up a surface mining operation in your neck of the woods is a great start. In all honesty, I think that and informing those decisions, informing people, and when you see a for sale sign going up on a property, what can be done to help foster this dynamic between the real estate agent that represents the seller, right, and informing the purchasers of the property about the mining operation? Has that been considered?
Well, and I just want to add, too, that I think, this is also a community planning issue that needs to be, I think having Oliver at the table at some point is a really important thing as we're looking ahead to 2024. In a lot of ways, the complaints between the operator and the community are the same. Allowing rural residential to be sited adjacent to these heavy industrial operations don't work for anyone. And so there needs to be some foresight in planning, even in the rural areas. We think about planning mostly just inside the UGA, but looking ahead for planning in the rural areas as well.
So we'll bring Oliver back to the next meeting.
Conservation area.
Is this the independent study that you guys have done?
Yeah. No, we didn't have. Let's see.
That's a good point.
We didn't have this one done.
Not this one, no.
This one was done in 2013.
Oh. What's that one, Richard?
That one was done. What is it? I don't understand your
question. The Morganite, the certified.
I think it's 2013. I remember, right?
Who had it done?
The Willamette report.
That was
Willamette Geological was the independent lab that did it. You know more about this one.
That was done by a combination of citizens and Friends of the East Fork and Fish First and some fisheries groups that wanted to find out what the situation was.
And that was tested for Mortonite?
It was tested for whatever was there, and it showed up Mortonite.
Okay.
Just a quick time check, and then see if we can get a consensus opinion. Are you good for a little more time?
A little bit more.
Okay. Is everybody good for a little more time?
here.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. Okay, let's try in under 15 minutes, if that's okay. Good, because this is important. So thank you for the interruption. Please proceed. It's a good conversation.
Oh, that's on the Morton Eye?
Yes.
Oh. I don't know, Bo was asking about the study. I think Richard is more familiar. We got this after we had our we didn't know about this when we had our analysis done. Found out about this one later, which corroborated what we were finding.
So that was my question: does it confirm what you found?
Yes. Yeah.
Where were the locations of the samples similar? Were
2 miles away.
Okay.
We're 2 miles.
Yeah, ours is 2 miles away. This is closer to the mine, I believe.
In a home.
As I understand it, the people that did the official testing went up by the mine and below the mine on the road, did the whole area.
With the bridge?
Yeah, the bridge, the whole area, just to find out what was in the minerals, because we didn't know.
And maybe it's just a private conversation between us, but is that the one that we ended up in court over through Friends of the East Fork? I believe that is.
It could be. I'd have to talk to the lawyers to find out.
So if that test provides data to suggest that it's unsafe, why didn't that get resolved, is my question.
You'd have to talk to the lawyers that did all the communications, because I was, to keep things from being biased, I was kept out of it.
It actually came to us from someone else.
Well, I'm not sure I understand what we're talking about here.
Oh, you probably wouldn't, but I saw Richard's name on it.
No, I understand. But this is about the source of the test and lawyers and stuff.
It was because it was paid for through Fish First and Friends of the East Fork. And I was on the board, so that's all my name.
Yeah, to me, all three studies
right,
that have been done,
I accuse myself.
The value of those, I think, leads us to believe that further testing would be beneficial. I wouldn't take this and say, okay, this is definitive. I wouldn't take ours. But I think all three of those point to some pretty strong evidence that it would be worthwhile to find out what's in that rock. If there's Mordenite there, then we've got to go from there. If there's not Mordenite there, like, it is also a possibility, it'd be good news for everybody.
One thing I want to point out is, like, for example, look at this picture of the overburden piles. I think this is one of the possible sources. Look off to the right where there's you can see the house. You can see the size of the piles. So the proposed idea right now is to make a barrier by putting more of those all along the south side. This is a real high wind area. We get gusts regularly to 35, and we have had them to 90, where they peak out the weather station. And then this is a little bit farther back, and you can see the slope, and the variations in the vegetation are historic landslides. The area is known for landslides, and it's documented on the Washington State DNR. You can find various pictures of the overlays of the steepness of the slope and past slides.
And this is this a forested hillside? At one point,
they
I'm sorry,
they couldn't log because of the environmental. But when you get around here,
right,
you
so
come
they have
down
to leave
here.
Those tree
this
stands.
This slopes down. There's a creek down there. It's really steep. I mean, I drove down there, and it takes 4-wheel drive and your lowest low to even get out of there.
So
there are big water ruts. And
right. So the overburden eventually that is used in reclamation, Bo?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
the overburden.
Yep.
Is eventually
yes
gone
post reclamation. Okay. Yep. Goes okay. Back into the slopes and. And trees to be planted on it.
Which I don't think trees will grow.
Right. So what are we talking about right now? The
overburden
preventing
pile.
The moving the overburden well, now to
we're still talking.
Sound?
We're still talking about dust.
Not a possible
dust?
Source
well,
of dust.
When you pile 80-foot mountains of overburden on the top of a high wind hillside, you're going to get dust blown off. And there's
well,
no
there's natural just from the logging that's done, but those. Berms that are put up, they're hydroseeded, and I mean,
I don't see
can you look at those pictures and tell me
sure.
That was hydroseeded?
When was the picture taken?
A week or two ago.
2 weeks ago.
Yeah. That's a recent picture.
So if you stated it 2 weeks ago, it probably hasn't
sprouted
yet.
We didn't see it 2 weeks
yet,
ago. We see it.
In the 5 years I've been there, I haven't seen anything grow on it.
How is it? Who controls the seeding schedule on those?
It's the best time to seed, but I know that we seeded up there.
Okay.
But which is what the.
But how successful is it? What kind of vegetation cover have you obtained? Do you have a sense, Bo? Is it approaching 100? But is it approaching 100% cover, or is it? Does it look like your lawn if you have
It doesn't look like that.
I'm just wondering whether it's relatively barren or you've been able to successfully vegetate the mounds.
We have success with it. I'll be up there tomorrow, and I can take some close-up pictures of it.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. Sure. Because that's something I had written down, you know, these large, tall, steep, overburdened piles of unconsolidated material. They're the most conspicuous feature you see when you're looking at Yakko Mountain, and as Maria has pointed out, you know, they're susceptible to winds,
and so you have
wind-driven mobilization, right, and you have water-driven because they're steep, and so as I've mentioned in the last meeting, you know, prior to mining, you have forest cover and coarse woody debris and duff, so that's like a sponge taking up the water, slowing its release and increasing its retention time.
Sure.
You take that material off, it becomes impervious, you have a very flashy system that is moving at higher velocities, can incorporate more fines, and so now you take a pre-mining scenario where it's all bedrock, you fracture that rock, you remove the forest, you increase the intensity of rain and the work that water can do flowing, and it all conspires to more fines being moved off-site, both by two vectors, wind and water. And it would be hard to argue otherwise. I mean, there's a rich body of literature on these aspects of hydrology and wind-driven systems.
So I have a couple of questions about timing relative to those observations. Now, for the reclamation work, is that an ongoing practice as you get rock
typically
out of an area?
This pit is much different than that because the whole thing has to come down, be daylighted, and then it's incised mining feature from that point on.
So you've got to hold off until
you've got to hold off with any storages because you can't even start reclamation until you start that incised mining. And that's a long ways away from now.
Right. And is that for economic reasons, or is that because DNR has a regulation that controls that?
That was the reclamation permit that was accepted.
Okay. All right.
And that's current.
What's the composition of those overburdened piles? Is it gray clay and orange clay? It looked like to me.
Orange, brown, soil classification would probably be like a CH, pretty fatty clay.
Okay, but it looked like in the photo there's some of that gray clay also.
I have to look at it.
Okay.
How much material did you have to remove to get to the rock that you're...
Right now there's roughly, I would say, 250,000 yards.
Yeah, but how deep did you have to go to hit the rock?
It would range from 2 feet deep to 25 feet deep.
Got it. Okay.
What do you think that costs?
To move?
To get to that rock, through the overburden. Which you just described.
You'd have to move 250,000 yards of dirt, and I mean, any public works job where you put it out to bid to move 250,000 yards of material gets to
a lot of attention.
High six figure number.
Yeah.
So one reason I brought this up is my concern is the talk has been to put more of those to create a sound barrier.
It's to move that pile
in a high wind
to
area.
A different area. To move that pile where currently sits to a different area.
Mm-hmm. Not to add more piles?
More would be added to that pile because there's still more overburden to remove before it daylights.
Well, but not nearly as daylight. I'm just trying to
expose the rock. Okay.
So if you've got a mountain peak like this, daylight would be once it's at this flat elevation, and then you start mining down from there.
Besides Bo, who here has dealt with DNR? So would it be valuable to the group to have DNR come join us for a meeting?
Yeah.
Do you have a name we could reach out to, Bo, that is familiar with your operation?
Ryan Scove is the head of DNR Mining.
Is that S-K-O-V-E?
I think it's S-K-O-V.
Okay.
There's a Brian Massey, and I won't burden the other guy, no.
We're going to have.
You want to show up anyway.
We're going to have a pretty. If we get everybody that we're going to ask to the next meeting, it's going to be a pretty robust meeting.
Can we spread them out over a couple meetings just so that we don't have to.
That would probably be a good idea. Because, I mean, just this, you know, this type of conversation, and as it evolves, it has a tendency to take on a life of its own. And it's, we have an agenda, but it's just more of a kind of a guideline. Pardon me. It doesn't necessarily, it's we're covering all the bases. It's just in this kind of cool discussion. What I'd like to, we have a lot of work ahead of us. We have a lot of things we need to do in the way of getting information and getting the website built out for everybody, posting the information that we promised we'd post on it. What I want to promise to the group is that before we post anything that has anyone's name on it, we'll reach out to you for written permission to make sure that you're okay with that, whether it's a communication you've sent us or whether it's an observation you've made or a complaint you filed. We want to make sure that everybody's okay with that. I mean, everything is subject to public disclosure. We are a public agency. All our meeting records, all our notes, everything we're keeping here is subject to public disclosure. So if the things that have been circulated here, if you want to take the pictures back with you, that's fine. But if you want to send them to me for posting, that's also fine.
Okay. Is it better to send attach photos when we email you, or
that's wonderful when you do that.
You get warnings not to click on links.
We do, but if it's coming from someone we recognize and you're on our contacts list, we're not too concerned with it. I was talking to Dick about the challenges he has with his internet, and you know, I don't know if you've got a better option, but there's always snail mail.
Right. Well, I can get it done.
What?
Good.
Hey, so we talked about blasting notices last meeting.
Yes.
It's way more convenient and much more cheap for me to email those notices. In the CUP right now, it requires that I send certified mail. And there's maybe four people that don't return those back to me, and I've got drawers full of $2.49 postage that just come back once a week from dozens and dozens of people. If you can get that change out of the CUP where I no longer have to do that and people can sign up with an email list,
okay,
would be way easier for everybody.
Let me check with the PA's office to make sure that that's doable. I think if the intent of the rule was notification, I'm going to err on the side of reasonableness and say we should be able to find a way to do that and make that happen.
Sure.
But let me check with our attorney. I'll get on that tomorrow. That'll be first question out of the barrel.
Sure.
That makes sense.
Maybe you have to notify all the people that are on the list.
Yeah.
That's
acceptable.
Challenge.
Yeah, of course. That's what you're
going to find out. Well, at one point, that was what the deal was to get rid of that certified mail and just go to a phone call or an email. And there was like three people that said, no, I want certified mail.
Okay.
So it's all or nothing. So we'd have to get everyone to agree, I guess.
Yeah.
I have a question or a point to make as far as from a staff perspective of maintaining this website. I'm not the person that maintains it,
right,
but I'm representing the person that maintains it because we don't really have a dedicated one staff person for this. With a promise to not post anything with anyone's name on it and ask permission to post on the website, it would be much easier if you don't want it posted and you state that you don't want it posted and everything else is clear to be posted, because requiring a staff member to reach out and contact each person on each document, we get a lot of mail on this, and I think that would really create a burden. So I feel like, you know, everyone needs to know that anything they submit is going to be a public record. But if they don't want to post on the website, then they could add that to their email of, this is not to be posted on the website. I understand this is part of the public record. That could really assistant streamlining staff.
So whether we post it or not on a website doesn't diminish our responsibility to make it available in a public records request.
Absolutely.
That's okay. That'll always be a requirement for us.
Yes. About blasting notices. So, in Livingston, same requirements in the CUP for certified mail. It's been changed mostly to email, or I don't know how it's actually, I think mostly it's been done by email. But in fact, the blasting notice doesn't have any useful effect in the way it's currently enforced, because once a week, the people that are on the list get a note that says sometime during the next week, there's going to be blasting. Then the next week, you get a notice, say sometime during the next week, there's going to be blasting. This means that forever, there's going to be blasting. You don't know when it's going to be. The kids don't know when there's going to be an explosion.
That's why certified mail is such a challenge. How do I give you the notice and give you any? I'm required to do it with a certain amount of days' notice.
I'm not arguing.
I know it's a pain to do certified
mail. I'm not arguing the venue. I'm saying that the provision itself is sort of not doing what it was intended to do, which is you'd like to know that at 5 o'clock on Thursday there's going to be a big explosion so you can warn your kids. But, you know, on Monday, you get a letter certified or you get an email that says sometime during the next week there's going to be blasting. The notice doesn't say the blasting. You all know when the blasting is going to happen because you've got a contract with your guys. They show up here at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
That letter tells you nothing. It just tells you that in the next week we're going to light a shot off.
So why is
in Calhoun County, we have a phone system, and there's maybe 13 people that want to be notified. And the person that's operating the scale shack calls each and every one of those people and says, tomorrow between the hours of 3 and 5, we're going to be lighting this off. It's that simple.
But why don't the letters or the email?
Because I can't send you a letter through certified mail because my circumstances can change.
But in our area, it's mostly done by email, right?
It's not. Okay. Certified mail. And or phone calls to people that say,
I just say it's worthless, the certified mail, because nobody gets
it. I agree.
So I concur. It sounds like there's a little wiggle room here, because if there have been, there's an essentiality for more targeted information, day of week, time of day.
Right. If it wasn't required, I wouldn't do it, and I'd say, put your name and number on the list, and we'll call you the day in advance.
Bo, how well dialed in is the timing of any particular blast that your contractor's doing for you? Is it a two-hour window, a four-hour window generally?
Well, we shut the pit down when stop all truck traffic, uh-huh. Crushing, everybody goes down. So we want to do that at the end of the day when the sales are done. So it's always, it's generally between 3:30 and 5 o'clock.
Yeah, so that's great. I mean, you'll know the day and you'll know a two-hour window. I mean, if people are interested in collecting dust samples, or people are interested in telling their children, or bringing their goats into shelter, or whatever it is.
Emails or phone calls the day before make a ton of sense. So it would make sense.
That seems like a
change that provision.
But I want that change in the CUP, so I'm not out of compliance with the CUP by not sending certified mail to notify.
So that's my question, is if we're going to modify this specific requirement of the CUP, is there a way to do that without having to invoke the entire process?
Yeah.
I'm hoping. If not, then let's think about writing that into the next CUP so we can fix it.
Yeah.
It seems to me that as you come up across circumstances that you didn't prepare well for, you should be able to make adjustments. Hopefully there's a mechanism for that. We'll have an answer tomorrow.
And if this is a modification, is this an opportunity to look at other aspects of the...
Normally when you open a CUP up, it is. That's the question. Is there a hazard there that, you know, that we have to go and open up the entire process? And if
or,
we do that,
or an opportunity.
Right. Well, it's an opportunity. Yeah. It is.
But the glass half full.
Yeah. But the time constraints are substantial. I mean, getting a docket with a hearing examiner is not the easiest thing to do, believe me.
Yeah. Right. Bo's trying to be helpful here. I mean,
I would sort of rather see the change be able to be implemented quickly, so that at least can be implemented without bogging it down and other issues.
Yeah, that's
what
that's
I would say is, if you can make that an easy change to a CUP, a change in the CUP that favors the operator in a way which you don't agree with will have equal status for a quick change. You may want to think twice about what we have.
You don't get a CUP change that benefits the operator without the process.
Yeah. Doesn't matter. I mean, this is a change that everybody would agree to.
Everybody, not just the operator.
Yeah. And even if we in spite of maybe not being able to eliminate the registered mail for Bo, couldn't we add the email notification in addition to that?
In lieu of, in addition
well,
to.
Well, in addition. Yeah. If you can't eliminate that annoyance for you, right. You could still take care of everybody else and those people that are getting certified. Maybe that would demonstrate to them that they could easily live without that certified mail if they have internet. But anyway, the rest of us would.
That's why when we discussed the posting the blasting schedules online and mm-hmm. having that certainty in the day of the week and time of day in a public forum or format gives access to it even when notification may not be received. But I have a commitment from council to do work with this forum to make things happen. So this is a great example of something where we can go back to the regulators and say, hey, can we fix this? Can we make this more user-friendly? It's not too much to ask.
On this topic, but as long as we're talking about blasting notification and efficacy. So, conditional use conditions change. The radius that were set up in the CUPs as to who had to be notified also is tied into who was involved in the original hearing process. The circumstances of the quarry at each of the quarries in Clark County have changed over time. In Yockel, they changed drastically in a fairly short number of years. In Livingston, they changed incrementally. In fact, one of the issues still in play has to do with something called a sound barrier. As those things change, the number of people impacted change. It probably goes down in some directions, and it goes up in other directions. Mm-hmm. I know at the hearing on Yockel, the operator suggested that actually some of the blasting noise had gone down as you got further down in the air shaft. Right? In Livingston, it changed because the configuration of the two pits changed as they were mined out. Just I'm not complaining, just a statement of fact. Where we live, we have a much stronger impact. In fact, we're not required to be notified, but because of the change in the configuration, because of the ridge of rock down the top of the ridge of Livingston Mountain, we get boomed like we were right next to it in a way that didn't happen 5 years ago. It's just that, somebody else is probably not having the same thing. And in fact, when people are on the social media saying, oh my God, did you hear that, which is what happens, there are people that you go, how could they not have heard that? And there are people going, my God, the dishes fell off the wall.
Right.
And it's changed over time. And that's another one of these conditional things, which there needs to be some way that this, to be useful, the notification has to be going to the people that are going to be impacted, and it needs to go in a timely way, whatever that happens. I just throw that out as a complaint, just an observation as we go forward.
Well, that's a good one.
One of the things that changed at Yakul was the clear cut. So originally, I think there was a 500-foot notification or something. The mountain got clear cut, and now 2 miles away, we should be notified because it jolts our whole house in our neighborhood. Didn't used to do that.
And when the hearing examiner heard that case, he wouldn't have been aware of it.
Right.
Wow. Okay. Boy, I'm sure going to enjoy getting some help with all this.
Oh, yeah.
Merrily is fantastic, and as is the rest of my staff, but she did bring up a very good point about resourcing. It was the intent of council to ensure this was resourced properly, so I have support for that. And we'll make sure that we have everybody that we need in the background, making sure things are updated properly, communications are given timely. And we're being as accountable as we possibly can be to this process, but both to the mine operator and to you and to ourselves, because some of the things that we are challenged with deal with not only resourcing, but how we manage consistent responses and responsiveness in our community. And it depends sometimes on who you talk to as to what kind of response you get from us. And we really need to ensure that in this particular venue especially, that we're really consistent and on message and delivering the information that's critical to your success and your decision-making and your understanding of how things work.
Will we be, pardon for interrupting, will we be notified by email of our next meeting?
Everybody that's on this list and on that list will receive an email.
Okay, because I didn't get it this time.
I agree with that.
Through the group.
So we're going to create the contacts list that we'll get a blanket email out along with the agenda and stuff like
Thank
that.
Thank you.
You bet.
Can you quickly?
So Marilee is going to be kind enough to walk through our website that we've set up for this, so you can kind of get an idea how to cruise through it. So if I can draw your attention to the screen. Okay.
Okay, so first off, there's a comment that I want to make about Nextdoor, which a lot of people have said they use that app to get information. And a lot of people do not understand that Nextdoor was designed for you to create your own neighborhood boundaries, and it is private to your neighborhood. So a lot of times people will do an entire string of complaining and saying, we need to talk about this intersection, or we need to talk about this pothole in the road. And they feel like because they put it on the internet that we know about it. And we don't. We don't see it. We don't know about it. And we get a lot of complaints that folks can see that. If I post something out to you, and you will see stuff posted out from me, if you comment on my post, I can see that. But anything else on Nextdoor is not visible to me other than my own. I can see things in my own neighborhood, but I live within the city limits. This new website that was set up by Community Development is, I went to the Community Development page, which you can, I'm going to go backwards on here. So this is the main page on Clark County, and you can go into departments and go down to Community Development, and then there is a menu that's down here, and that one of the menu items is Surface Mining and Advisory Committee. They've put a list of things on here of what the purpose and the form structure is going to be. They have links to the quarries. They have the website set up here for, the email set up here for where you can comment direct to that multiple people are on board with, so that multiple people will see those emails in case somebody's out of the office. There's more than one person who's monitoring that email address. And then these are the meetings, which will have the agendas and then materials that are looked at during the meeting, and meeting notes, and then the audio from the meeting. And these aren't transcribed. It's brief notes, and it's what we can capture and what we can hear. So it'll be more of an outline than the actual play-by-play of who said this. And even if I had a transcriptionist go over this recording, they aren't going to be able to tell who was talking because you're not identifying yourself. This isn't a legal proceeding. It's an informal meeting. So we do have an audio recording of it that people can listen to, but there's not an actual transcription of it in these meeting notes. And another resource that I felt like should probably be brought up is underneath of the community planning website, there is also an entire page for when they did the surface mining overlay update, which I know that the Livingston Mountain people know about because they attended almost all of those meetings. I got to know most of them very well during that time because I was a planning commission clerk. This has the updated surface mining overlay map on it. It has quarry overlay district transportation reports. This is historic from 2014. It's not current, so this is 5 years old. But it does show you when there was references being made earlier in this meeting regarding mining can only be done where it's determined that it can be done. That would be this surface overlay map. Whoops. Oh, maybe this is it right here.
Those are the Planning Commission recommendations.
So I don't think this is the final, and I'm not as familiar with this page any longer, but it looks like it's either taking a really long time to load. You'd have to zoom in on what your area is, which is doable down here on this little bar. And then you can move over with these bars and see exactly in your area where this has been designated and approved for mining to be done in Clark County. And as Mr. Sordahl said, this is
this is probably the draft from Planning Commission, but it lets you know where these are. And if you're using your computer and you're zooming in, depending on how fast your dial-up speed is, it might take a while for this to load, I'll warn you. Because it's a huge file.
Just so everyone knows here, the green are the areas. The yellow are the areas that were removed. So that's...
The dark green.
The dark green are the areas that are inside the surface mining over
there.
So
these ones.
The yellow are what was proposed by the Mineral Lands Task Force, but were removed. So those aren't areas that are possible to mine.
And that was in 2013? Well,
yes.
2014.
But... If you're interested in the history of some of the discussion and how this works in the comprehensive plan, you can go to that website, and that whole process is on that webpage. I'll add this link to the notes so that you can go to this link. Since there will be another comprehensive plan coming up, it would be good if you're wanting to be a part of this process to familiarize yourself with what is on here.
Are there any maps that shows potential sites or where there are some deposits known? Because I've seen those maps before.
I'm not sure how many maps they've got on this particular website. I know there's a lot of stuff on here because I was still working down there at that time, and I loaded almost everything that came across my desk onto that site. So
there were some when the Planning Commission was first looking at it, there were sites identified, and as Bo said, they were ruled out.
The USGS, yes. United States Geologists, would show potential areas where rock could be or should be, but it's not always accurate.
Bo, when you guys do a survey on our new site, do you look at rock quality, right?
Quality.
And what do you need to satisfy yourself that there's a decent enough rock quality? What is a rating?
There's quantity and quality, but there's state standards, LA wear, degradation, specific gravity for weight, absorption. There's standards that must be met before you can supply a public works project, any municipal project. So it needs to at least meet those standards at a minimum. We'll often get into a place where there's huge amount of volume there, but you test it and you do 150 drill holes and then you get composites of each and it doesn't even meet the standards for state rock. So you can only sell it for driveways and that kind of stuff, private.
Is that work only done in surface mining overlay areas?
No.
So that can be done anywhere.
If I know the property owner and get an agreement to go up and do some exploratory work, then that's where it starts.
So how long is the process from the point you're doing your sampling to the point you're actually mining?
It's a year to determine, at least a year to determine if it's even doable, once you look at all the mitigation factors. And then in Clark County, you'll do a pre-app for an addition of a surface mining overlay expansion area to be added. That's a year-long process. And then permitting could take anywhere from a year to 4 years, just depending on what you have out in front of you for obstacles.
Okay. How long does it take to get the DNR reclamation permit?
It's pretty quick. Once you get the SM6 signed from Clark County, DNR, they do them all the time, and they'll look at and put their 2 cents in on what they want done, and they can turn that around in a few months.
Okay. Would it be beneficial to the group to have a map for the process, the actual surface mining process from start to finish, or a roadmap, or a time frame?
All of the Planning Commission stuff is still up. I just tested the website.
Yeah.
And here's the April 17th, 2014 work session, and it has the Planning Commission mapping votes, the DNR map, the Mineral Lands Task Force recommendations, the Planning Commission recommendations, the DNR letter, and it would also have the audio from that on this page as well. So,
I guess I'm more curious about it than anyone, since I'm kind of the guy that's supposed to know.
And the history of the project should still, if they haven't taken the page down, it should still be on here. Yeah, this is your timeline right here. The background is historical information is all on the surface mining overlay page on the community planning website. And I can add these links to the summary notes so that you can just click on them and you won't have to write all these down.
That would be awesome. Wow.
I normally wouldn't know this, but since I sat in these hearings until 1 o'clock in the morning, I'm pretty familiar with them.
I think Oliver or Jose can explain that process. You know, some folks don't even know that these proposals go to the Planning Commission before they go to the Council. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't understand much of the process. So. And that it's not, you know, 2024 is the change, but it'll start several years before then.
Yes. Wow, we covered a lot of ground here tonight. I thank you all for joining us, for staying here. I hope you find this as valuable as I do. This has been this is kind of evolving as from meeting to meeting, but it's really yielded some good information and I think progress.
Let me just say that sitting around the table is a lot more satisfactory than.
I love this format. I wish we had better recording devices, but you know, for all intents and purposes, it meets our needs. So. Good luck in Cowlitz County. You've got an advocate. You're welcome anytime.
So a date for the next one hasn't been set.
No, we won't. We're going to have to look at that. I want to look at the body of work I have to do to get the meeting. Forum set up.
Okay.
Get the forum set up. That's going to be a big ask. So I get all these pictures that y'all are leaving behind.
Probably get better lights.
Yeah. That would be awesome.
Yeah. They'll be better quality anyway, probably electronically.
They do. And we can also.
By the time you print these and then scan them again, they're going to be terrible.
You bet.